After sitting for a full year, hearing from more than 300 witnesses, and deliberating for more than 40 hours, the jury in the Stardust inquests have reached their verdict. If you've listened to the previous 6 episodes of this podcast, you'll understand how important this process was for families and survivors. Their decades of fighting for truth and closure, facing seemingly insurmountable obstacles at every turn, finally paid off when the state granted a major new investigation into what happened at the Stardust's Valentine's Disco in 1981. You'll recall at the end of the last episode of this series, the family's fight for fresh inquests was vindicated, and over the past year, the coroner has presided over the hearings in the pillar room in the Rotunda. Today, the jury of 12 returned a majority verdict of unlawful killing for all 48 people who died. We're bringing the Stardust podcast back for an immediate look at today's verdict. It is absolutely monumentous for the families, but also for the state, so we'll be combing over in finer detail in the weeks to come as well. You don't know my voice, I'm Sinead O'Carroll, the editor of The Journal, which produced the Stardust podcast, and I'm joined in studio with the two producers of the series, Christine Bohan, who is also our deputy editor, and Nikki Ryan, who is also our senior media producer. Both have stayed across the story since you listened to the Stardust podcast and are up to date in everything that has happened across the inquests in the past year. They're actually both just back from the coroner's court, so let's start there. Christine, what's your headline from it all?
The headline for me was the fact that it was an unlawful killing verdict. Nobody knew what was going to happen when the jury came back into the room. And I say that after talking to people throughout the entire inquest process over the past year, from talking to people during the jury deliberations over the past 11 days, nobody was willing to put their money where their mouth was or to say that this was what the jury were going to come back with, because there were 5 different options available to them. And unlawful killing was always the one that had the highest burden of proof. If the jury wanted to come back with unlawful killing, they had to be satisfied beyond reasonable doubt that there was something illegal that happened in the Stardust that night that led to these people, the 48 people dying. For the other 4 options available to them, they had to be satisfied on balance of probability that this is how the 48 people died. But unlawful killing was different to all the other verdicts that were available. So it was more difficult. It needed to reach a higher bar than the other verdicts if the jury were going to return that. So I think people just did not know what was going to happen. And that really, you could feel that in the room. So I was there from like a few hours before the jury came back in. And there was just this real sense of just nervous anticipation, of hope. I would say that was a big thing that you could really feel in the room. But just this kind of just nerves, just you could feel the tension. And you don't often, it's hard to say that. When people say that, you kind of go, oh, but how could you feel it? But in that room today, you could feel the tension.
Yeah, Nikki, while that's the kind of headline that Christine picked out, we did actually, you know, hear more from the jury about what they decided happened on that night as well.
Yes, as part of their process, part of this questionnaire that the jury had to complete, one of the questions on that was, are you able to establish the cause of the fire? Now, anyone who has listened to this to the series, anyone who has followed the story of the Stardust fire knows that there is such doubt over how exactly the fire started. Obviously, the Keene Tribunal initially said that it was probably started deliberately, which caused such anger for many, many years for the families. That tribunal also said that it was actually not clear at all, really, how the fire happened. This was just the most likely explanation. So it wasn't even that strong in it. And it took until 2009 for that to be struck from the public record. There was an extra examination of evidence put forward by the families. And the senior counsel who led that review decided that the tribunal was wrong to even come to that conclusion. So that was struck from the record, but it was still hanging over the story as, how did the fire start? And the jury came back when they were asked, can you establish how the fire started? And they said yes. And there was audible gasps, because this was very unexpected that they could come to this definitive conclusion. And they said that it happened in the hot press next to the dispense bar, which is also called the main bar. And if you had asked me before, even before this process had concluded, what were the standout moments from the entire process itself, and I would have said the evidence around that hot press really made it look like this was possibly where the fire started, and the fire may have from there travelled into the roof space and spread to the roof space, and then was only in the west alcove where it had dropped down, that's when it was first noticed. So this is a huge part of the Stardust story, and I'm actually very, very surprised that we're sitting here today to say that we actually have an answer now.
And it's so interesting, because I think this was not clear at all in the 1980s, particularly in the tribunal that was held around the Stardust. Because when you heard the evidence during the inquest about the condition of the hot press at the bar, I think we were talking about this, Nikki, at the time, but everything was pointing to the hot press mm-hmm. as being the source of the fire. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand, having read the Keane report in depth, having done so much work on the Keane report, I don't understand why that wasn't clear at the time.
It also explains the feeling or the experience some of those people in the fire had, that they, or that people outside saw the fire first,
yeah.
you know, that and it went yes. through the ceiling. So, you know, something was happening, but I couldn't see it.
Like, it answers so many questions.
It does and answer a lot
that's,
of questions.
That's something to mention briefly as well, that there's always been talk of the fire being spotted outside of the club before yeah. it was seen inside. There's a photograph that's been presented by the campaigners over the years called the Blair photograph, which shows flames on the roof. And the person who took it said they took it at, I think it was around 25 to 2, which was minutes before it was spotted inside. But that's been reviewed several times, and it was never conclusively found that these people did definitely see it outside the club before people saw it inside. But now, this is lending more credence to that theory.
It just puts all the jigsaw together.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly a lot of things that we knew about or had heard about, it just makes so much more sense.
While you were in the room, we were in the office watching it on Zoom. And interestingly, the Zoom capacity hit its maximum today. The number of people who were watching it was 500, and they couldn't let any more in. But we were watching it here, and it was that answer when they said, have you been able to determine where the fire started? They said yes. And, you know, I dropped everything that I was doing and just couldn't look away at that point.
There was such a gasp in the room when that happened.
That's what what was the room? Because here we could feel the tension, and there's only, you know, a few journalists in a newsroom. What was it like there?
I should say the room was absolutely crowded. So on a normal day of the inquest, it would fit about 100 people. And there were over double that, I would say, today. There's more than 200 people in the room, in the pillar room, in the rotunda. So it was so crowded. The legal teams actually gave up their tables so that the families would have places to sit in the room. People were standing shoulder to shoulder at the back of the room. It was like at mass, you know, when people turn up late, you know, when you're a kid and they have to stand at the back of the room. I was standing at the back of the room, wedged in beside people. So I think there was a real sense of kind of tension and anticipation, but also kind of, there was kind of a respect that felt like it was being paid to the victims as the foreman was reading out the cause of death of everybody. Like, that was actually quite moving, even though, you know, that was known from the 1980s, that we knew how people died, like from the fumes in the room or from the smoke in the room. So, I mean, that was known, but to hear it almost felt like kind of a moment of respect for the victims. And I think that's been so central to the entire inquest process.
What was that moment like then when the foreman said unlawful killing?
I've never seen anything like that in a courtroom. Like, I've been a reporter for like almost 20 years now at this stage. I've never seen anything. It was just absolutely extraordinary. I think there was a pause for almost a second of just silence, and the room took it in, and then there was a cheer. So the families were all sitting down on the kind of on the opposite side of the room to the jury, so kind of at the far end from where the jury were. And this cheer went out, just a yell, and it was just the relief and just the sense of, oh, it's happened.
And there was such kind of jubilation that the coroner wasn't telling people to stop, but she was like, please bear with us for another few minutes. We have more to come, but, you know.
And people immediately, you know, even though this has been probably one of the biggest moments of their lives, the families immediately sat down and again were silent and just were like, of course, we'll observe the process. We'll, you know, allow for everything else that has to happen now to happen now. But it was just that maybe 5 or 10 seconds there. Like, that was so moving.
And that was the next thing then, because the coroner did say there was kind of more official proceedings. The foreman had to sign the official declaration, but also they had recommendations to make as well. What did they say?
So there weren't a huge number of recommendations, unsurprisingly, because the fire happened 43 years ago. So a lot of things that needed to happen after Stardust did. There were a lot of changes in fire safety rules. But I thought it was really interesting that the jury recommended two things. They said there should be more inspections of hotels, nightclubs, pubs, places that people can kind of go to at night, really. So at the moment, 70% of these places are inspected every 2 years. And what the jury said was that 100%, so all hotels, pubs, clubs, nightclubs, they should all be inspected every single year. And the other one was that there should be frequent revision to the building regulations that Ireland has. So basically to keep pace with changes in building uses and to make sure that building codes are up to scratch, that there needs to be more frequent revision to these. So I think what we can take from that is that the jury were zooming out from the fire itself and saying that this happened in Stardust, but we need to look at the country as a whole and make sure that this does not happen again, that no one should ever have to go through this.
Because those 12 jurors, they had to sit through, what did we say, over 300 witnesses, over a year of testimony. They're kind of experts in this now. So they're the ones who know more than anyone except the families, like what the impact of something like this does to
exactly. And I think it's so hard to get someone to pay attention to building regulations or to fire safety regulations. Like this is, you know, the time when it's in the news now. It's like, as you say, this jury knows what it's talking about. And I think for the government, they'd be well advised to listen.
Mm. Nikki, I mentioned the families there, and they're the most important people today. And I know through producing the podcast, the two of you did such a great job of making sure that they were central to this and the victims were central. What are they saying today?
The families, after the court had finished sitting, they all spoke to the media afterwards outside. And Antoinette Keegan, who's obviously been such a huge part of the Stardust story, and her mother, Christine, and her father, John, throughout the years, that family have been central to the story. She lost her two sisters, Mary and Martina, in the fire, and she herself was badly injured as well. She was speaking to reporters outside of the Pillar Room, and she was just saying she's really overwhelmed. And she said, it was a day that we've waited for a long, long time. All the families have been waiting a long time for this. And, you know, they've been waiting 43 years for this, you know, to finally have the truth that they've wanted all along, really. There was also Lisa Lawler. She lost both of her parents, Maureen and Francis, in the fire. She was just a baby at the time. And here's what she said.
It's been a battle, to say the least, for the last 43 years. I was only one. I was in Nappies. When the last time I saw me, both my parents, they went to the Stardust and they didn't come home. Just thank the legal team, coroner, the media, everyone who has brought us through this for the last year or for the last 43 years. Thank you very much.
Then there's also Bridget McDermott, who's 87. She is the mother of three children who died in the Stardust fire, George, William and Marcella. And her grandson, Connor, was there today and he spoke to our reporter, Eimear McCauley.
She's just overwhelmed, and she just keeps praying, and she's prayed her entire life. And I think truth, that was the main thing. She just wanted the truth about what happened to her kids. And I think that's what everyone else here wanted as well, just the truth and answers. And I think we've got that today. So, yeah, no one's going to be confused on what happened in Stardust anymore. We know what happened, and it's been written in the course today. So, yeah, over the moon.
Yeah, there were a number of moments of the inquest that really stood out for me over the past year. But one of them was when Bridget McDermott spoke about what she had lost, because her family lost more than anybody in this fire, with, you know, three of her children died. And she spoke about her children when the pen portraits were happening at the very beginning of the inquest. And I think it's worth just like listening to her words about it. She said, "I am the mother of William McDermott, Marcella and George, who I loved very much. They went out that night and they never came home to me, and I miss them. And I love them. God bless them."
And like, I mean, it is impossible for us to mention every single one of these stories, but anyone who has been following the inquest at all or is aware of the story of the Stardust fire at all know that there are 48 people who died in this fire, and each one of those people had a family, and each one of those, they were able to share their story at the inquests and explain to the public properly what these people meant to them and what impact their loss had on them.
Yeah, because this isn't something that happened long ago in history. You know, 43 years, in some ways it's nothing. You know, for these, and you could see for these families, it's still something that they're living with, because they've never had the closure on their grief that you might have if, you know, if a family member dies and a funeral happens and you know why they died and how they died. There is a sense of closure that comes with that, and it's still horrific, and we all, you know, a lot of us have been through it, and it's so, so hard, but you're able to move through those stages. And I think without getting the answers that they needed to get, it was, you know, it's left open for them. And so I think one of the things that the inquest did, which is very unusual, it's never happened before in an Irish inquest, but was to have the pen portraits at the beginning, which is something that happened with the Hillsborough inquest in England a few years ago, where it gave the space for the families to be able to speak about the victims. And Dr. Myra Cullinan, who was the coroner for these inquests, she said that it was really important because it put the victims at the centre of the process, because the entire inquests were about how these people died, not about blame, not about, you know, finding anybody innocent or anyone guilty. It's about, why did these 48 people never come home? And the other thing that she said about them was that it was a way for the jury to hear about who these people were. So it isn't just an abstract number of 48 people who died, but they hear, you know, Jimmy Buckley was somebody who loved performing. He loved going up to the Donaghmede Inn. He did, you know, great Elvis Presley impressions. And they hear these things and they go, oh, okay. Like for me, I found listening to some of the Penn portraits and hearing the descriptions of people, it would put me in mind of my friends and family. When you would hear things like, oh, this person was the joker of the family, I would go, I know exactly which sister of mine that is.
Nikki, this whole inquest was such a mammoth undertaking. We've kind of given the top line figures around like the number of witnesses and how long they've spoken for. But just in terms of precedence or history, how big actually was this inquest?
Yeah, I mean, these inquests have been taking place since last April. And we've spoken a bit about how long the jury took to come to their verdicts and their recommendations. But this has been sitting for months now. It has heard from literally hundreds of witnesses, and that ranges from people who were there on the night, people who lost loved ones describing the impact on their lives. We've mentioned the fire experts as well, who really delved into the nitty-gritty of how this fire spread, how it happened, how the furnishings in the building contributed to how intense this fire was. And we also saw people, you know, like Eamon Butterley, who was the manager of the Stardust. He was someone who had obviously given evidence at previous inquiries, but he would very much stay out of the kind of the spotlight around the story, and he wouldn't have been very much involved at all with the previous reviews of evidence. So this is the first time in a long time that he was out in public speaking to a court about what had happened that night.
And I think it's fair to say that his evidence was at times contradictory. It was at times difficult to follow. I actually found it quite hard to follow at times.
That was one thing when we were trying to, obviously we've been covering the inquests over the past year, and there was a particular issue with Eamon Butterley's evidence, and he did answer all the coroner's questions, all the questions from the legal counsel as well, who were there to question every witness that came up. And obviously, and he did give evidence over several days, so it was a big undertaking by him. But in terms of what he was saying, it was very hard to parse, because he'd been asked very important questions around the practice of locking the doors and, you know, the process of how the club came to be in the first place. And it was very difficult to make, we couldn't really make head or tail of it at times. You know, you have to really carefully sit down and figure out what exactly is he saying here?
Yeah, particularly I would say around the practices in the Stardust at the time when he was the manager. And I think that there was probably an expectation that he was going to be not the star witness is the wrong phrase, but the witness who might shed an awful lot of light on what actually happened. That didn't quite happen across his days of evidence. I think there were other witnesses, particularly the expert witnesses, who told us more about, who really gave us more information about what happened.
Christine, through long legal battles, there's often things that can't be reported because of reporting restrictions. We have been able to report some of the things now that have happened in the past year. Probably the biggest of those, and think something that most people would be the most interested in, is Eamon Butterley trying to get a judicial review to stop the jury being able to make an unlawful killing verdict. You went to the court for those hearings. Can you tell us exactly what happened and what those days were like?
So the media weren't allowed to report on this when it happened, but we can talk about it now. And it's that Eamon Butterley went to court in the closing days of the inquest, just before the jury went out to deliberate on their verdict. And it was over the issue of whether or not the jury could return a verdict of unlawful killing. He was trying to seek a judicial review at the High Court, which would have had, you know, if it had passed, if it had exceeded, basically he was aiming to have unlawful killing removed as one of the options that the jury could return for the verdict. And this wasn't the first time he had tried to have that removed as an option. He had done that actually several times throughout the process. But this was right before the jury was due to deliberate. And it obviously would have had a huge impact on the inquest, on what would have happened.
We wouldn't have the verdict today if he had succeeded in that.
Yeah, it was a real, it was a hugely dramatic moment. And what happened was it ended up going to the High Court on Holy Thursday, just before Easter. And I was there, and the courts had actually broken for Easter already at that stage. So the four courts was completely deserted. Sorry, not completely deserted. There were painter and decorators in, actually, who were painting the interior of the four courts. But we went in and the judge gave his ruling and explained how he wasn't going to allow for leave for a judicial review to happen. And Butterley's lawyers tried to argue quite strongly that he would still like to see it happen. The judge pushed back and said that that wasn't going to happen. And there was this real tension between the two, with Eamon Butterley's lawyers pushing for it, the judge saying that he had literally been up all night working on it and that it wasn't going to happen. And the lawyers for the families who were also there, just said that they accepted the judge's verdict and asked that they could all just go back to the inquests to allow for the jury to begin their deliberations, actually. So it was just, I think it speaks to something that the jury did not know about at the time, but it shows how strongly Eamon Butterley fought for unlawful killing not to be an option that the jury could return.
Nikki, just to go back a little bit for people maybe who, you know, it's been a while since the podcast came out. Just why exactly were these inquests taking place? Can you give us the kind of history behind why now, why 43 years later?
So I think this is something that it's come up within a few conversations over recent months, is the fact that we did actually have inquests into the Stardust fire in 1982. So the Keane Tribunal was actually underway at the time, and they took place over, you know, we're talking about a process right now that lasted since last April. The original inquests took just 5 days, I believe it was. And they were just focused on determining how and where and when these people died. They did not consider a wider verdict or the wider circumstances around how people died in the Stardust.
So they basically said, as a result of fumes, smoke inhalation,
yeah.
Fumes, yeah.
Yeah. And so the basis of the renewed campaign by the Stardust campaigners and their legal teams in the late 2010s, this was focused on making a case that these should be reopened because they didn't properly explore all the circumstances. And the Attorney General at the time agreed, and that's why we're here today. Essentially, it was that there was an insufficiency of inquiry around the original inquests. And now this had always been the case. It just was an avenue that hadn't been explored and hadn't been addressed by the government of the time. And I don't think anyone is walking away from these thinking that hasn't been an insufficiency of inquiry. There has very much been. I mean, some of the legal representatives who addressed the court at the very end of the hearings today did touch on that. The story of the Stardust has really been laid bare in huge detail.
I do think that speaks to something about the Irish state, though, that it has taken this long for inquests to take place, which should have happened in 1981. You know, and I think that Ireland has often been quite bad at dealing with justice for groups of people, like everyone from, you know, from Tuam to Priory Hall. There's just so many examples of justice not being served, justice delayed being justice denied, I think, is kind of the legal maxim that would apply here. But it's this kind of sense that the Irish state or the institutions of the state are ill-equipped at dealing, at understanding how to process this when it happens in a timely way, and what that justice looks like. And I think, you know, the courts deal with justice on a daily basis in a very clear and efficient way for individuals. But I think when it comes to groups, there is an issue there. This shouldn't have taken 43 years.
There has been lots of talk of closure today, but there's also been a lot of questions about what next. Is this the end now?
So when we're talking about the future, a lot of that revolves around a man called Dara Mackin. He's from Phoenix Law and he has represented the families for some time now. And he was one of the main legal representatives for the families throughout this entire process. And he was speaking to reporters after the verdict today. And he was basically asked, well, actually, I'll just let the reporter who asked the question ask it. And he's not here today with us in the room, but it's a familiar voice to, I'm sure, a lot of you.
Did you think when you took on the case, how many years ago, was it 2017, 2018, when you took on the case that you'd be here today?
When I first came on to this case, it was always clear to me that there's something was gravely wrong. I don't think I ever have seen a case whereby there has been so many failed investigations and the truth never been known. The reality is today is a testament to the family's dedication and commitment. And the reality is, when you know these families, there was never any doubt in my mind that we'd get to this day. These families are relentless. They have energy that is boundless and they are a true testament to their loved ones. So I always knew we'd get to this day, because not because I believed in lawyers, but because I believed in the families.
So broadly speaking, outside of the court today, a lot of families were touching on this point of that the state needs to now issue a formal apology over how they have been treated over the past four decades. And obviously it's over to the government now to see whether they will essentially apologise for what these people have been put through over decades. But when we're talking about the legal side of things, that was one question that was also put to Dara Mackin by our reporter Cormac Fitzgerald.
So the next step is that the families have now called upon the government to apologise. The reality is, as with any atrocity that's taken four decades to get to the truth, they deserve an apology. It is the very least that they should be offered. And we look forward to seeing the Taoiseach apologise to the families for what they've been put through.
Any legal route or anything like that?
Not at this stage.
Yeah. So obviously, a very quick answer there. Just anything of the legal route, not at this stage.
And I think we've already heard people asking the question about whether this will lead to any kind of criminal case. And just from talking to people who've been involved in the inquests, it does seem like it's very unlikely. And that's for a number of different reasons.
And I mean, that one thing on that, though, is that it is like very, very unlikely. But it is a sense of you can't say absolutely this won't happen.
Yeah, that's fair.
But it's really, it doesn't seem to be on the
table at
all.
Probability, it's not, no. It isn't really on the table.
No.
Partly because of the length of time that it's been since then. And there's just a number of other legal reasons why it may not be. There could be civil cases. The families haven't really spoken about whether that's something that may be an option for them. There could be barriers to that in that there was in the 1980s when some of them would have received compensation for what happened in the fire. They had to sign agreements at the time that said that they would not take further legal action in civil cases against the state, or they just would not take further action. So that hands may be tied in that situation.
And the thing is, it remains to be seen how watertight those agreements are. I would imagine that probably will be that they will not be able to take any civil cases. But there's also the possibility that there could be someone there who didn't take compensation from the compensation tribunal, and they may not have signed the agreement, and they could now be free to pursue a case, or someone else involved in the start of the story, because there's an awful lot of people.
And I think it's up to the families as well to decide for them what the end point looks like.
Yeah.
For some people, today is the closure that they needed or the end point that they wanted. For others, they might want to see something else happen. They want the state apology. If that happens, that would be the end point for them. So I think, you know, these are 48 different, you know, different people who died. So there's, you know, an awful lot. Not everybody will want the same thing. So we will see, I think, in the coming days and weeks and months of for the families what they want.
We spoke earlier about reporting restrictions, and when an inquest is going on, it's treated very much like a court case. So we had gotten advice not to push the Stardust podcast as a series out to people in case that it would influence the proceedings anyway, and we didn't obviously want to do that. But now we would love people to be able to revisit it and share it again and really tell the story to people who might not have known the impact that Stardust made on the community in North Dublin, but also on the state. And I think this ruling of unlawful killing and the reaction to it maybe will bring it to more people. So we'll be delighted to add this episode to the feed, and hopefully people will, you know, find the other episodes and listen and share as well. Thanks to Christine and to Nikki for producing such a wonderful piece of work on such an important story. And you can get more coverage and more details about everything that happened with these inquests and everything that happened in 1981 on the Journal.